You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Edmund White, the author most recently of The Farewell Symphony, a novel which is also the third book in his trilogy of autobiographical novels, A Boy's Own Story, The Beautiful Room is Empty, The Farewell Symphony. All of these have been published by Knopf in hardcover and are available or will be available from vintage and paperback. He's the author as well of a recent collection of his essays, The Burning Library, a collection of short stories, Skinned Alive, Our Paris, Sketches from Memory, with the illustrator Hubert Saurin. But our subject today is The Farewell Symphony and issues relating to autobiography and sexuality. I wanted to ask, there are certain figures who are named with their actual names, Isherwood and Bacardi, for instance, Peggy Guggenheim, others, and then others whose names, although invented, are so transparent if one knows the cultural life of New York that one finds oneself, you know, writing down Virgil Thompson, Richard Howard, James Merrill, Robert Wilson. What determined who would be a figure of culture and who would be renamed in the intimacy of the narrators?
Well, I think it was how much I developed them as a character. In other words, I think if I was simply making a reference to Peggy Guggenheim, a glancing reference, then I would leave her real name. And Foucault, though he was a good friend of mine, I never really developed as a character. So, but the other people you mentioned, I feel that I so thoroughly, I hope, rendered or recreated that they stand as characters on their own. So that, for instance, in France or even England, where most of them are unknown, those people you just mentioned, I think that people are able to read the book and derive some pleasure from it. I mean, I was looking at a annotated edition of Flaubert's Sentimental Education, in which actually every single character was based on somebody real, and it was really read as a roman or a clay at the time. Now, almost all of those people are entirely forgotten, but you can still read the book with pleasure. I think that a real roman clay is one that is only fun to read if you know who the real people are. I mean, in other words, there's a Hollywood columnist called Jane, and it's really a Hollywood columnist called Luella. But I think what I'm trying to do is to create characters that have an independent life of their own. And when they have an independent life of their own, at least by my estimation, I then give them a new name to show that they've sort of been translated into this land of the imagination.
What was the decision to stay as a novelist rather than an autobiographer?
Well, it seems to me that if I reported as much dialogue as I do and gave the most minute descriptions of people's bodies as I do and then claimed that was a memoir, everybody would laugh at me. They would say there's no way you could possibly remember all that. And in fact, I don't. You know, I don't remember it. I've sort of clothed my naked memories in the raiments of my imagination. I mean, in other words, I've sort of re-injected a kind of new life, I hope, into what would otherwise be very faded memories. Having written a real biography of Jean Genet, if I were writing a proper memoir, I think I would have done some research. I would try to nail down some dates. I would have written some people and said, what's your version of this? Really try to explore the cultural moment, because I mean I'm really writing in a kind of fragmentary and imaginative way perhaps about an interesting cultural moment, which was gay life and gay culture in New York in the 1970s. But I didn't do the research because I wasn't really interested in writing a social history. I was really interested in writing a book that would be about my own sexuality, that would be about my own development as a writer, and that would be about friendship.
Now, we've spoken before about the trajectory that has taken you from the writing of austere symbolist novels, it seems to me, to writing novels that are more direct sociologically based, less elliptical in their styles. And you track that trajectory in this novel. You have Christopher Isherwood recommending that you become more, you know, direct, and that you do the essentials of portraiture. Most recently, I read in an essay of yours that had once been an address, I see that there's several steps beyond that. And you say that you no longer think, perhaps, that the quality of novels is important anymore, that in the wake of AIDS, literature is now a kind of personal testimony, and you even create an image of a glass xylophone, people being different vessels, being pinged by hammers, and a melody being played on them.
Well, that was an address that I gave to the AIDS conference, AIDS and Literature Conference in Key West in last January. And I think my feeling was that, at least for right now, we have this mass of testimony to enormous pain. And it seems to me almost frivolous to start trying to hand out grades. It would be like lining up a bunch of Auschwitz survivors and giving them marks for beauty or something. I mean, it doesn't seem to me very relevant. I mean, eventually, I suppose, another generation, a later generation, will decide which of these books is sufficiently imagined and realized so that it can stand on its own and be read with profit. But that's probably determined by a handful of critics in the next generation. But in any event, right now, I do feel that it's like all these projects. For instance, there's a thing here in Los Angeles called the Estate Project, which is a thing where all kinds of artists' records and artists' work, people who have AIDS, are being preserved. And I think there's, especially when people are cut off in mid-career, or when they're and their work isn't completed, or their lives don't seem to really make any sense. Why would they die so young? There's a tremendous desire to want to conserve what they have made, and this is archival drive, I think, behind so much of contemporary gay art, which is necessarily AIDS art.
I'm speaking to Edmund White, the author most recently of The Farewell Symphony. But you can see, I think, that more than in certain other cases, that a writer who was one of the very few young novelists whose work Nabokov approved, who begins a career liking Ivy Compton Burnett and Henry Green and Ronald Furbank more than Tolstoy, would be the last person one would expect to see years later disparaging the stylistic quality of novels in favor of testimony or sincerity. But these are the poles of your work. Yeah. And so I thought it would be interesting,
to bring that up.
That.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, when I sit down to reread a book, it's more likely to be one by Alan Hollinghurst than some Xeroxed poem that I got on the street. But on the other hand, I admire the whole drive behind. It seems to me, I guess it's a kind of conflict almost, but you could say, between a democratic idea of art and an elitist idea of art. And I'm very torn on that subject. I mean, sometimes I feel like an elitist, and sometimes, but I mean, for instance, like I came out very strongly in the New York Times not too long ago, maybe a year or two ago, against the whole idea of the canon. I mean, just saying that aren't canons really for people who want a very short reading list because they don't really like to read? And the people who really like to read are always asking their friends for more titles of books, just the way you, before this program, were asking me, what have you read recently? That's what people who like books do. And so rather than wanting a canon, they actually want a huge, long, crazy, ragbag list of books. And I think in the same way that that writing shouldn't be restricted to just a few priest-like figures, but it should be something that everybody does. And some of those writers will come to seem emblematic to a generation and others won't. But I think the desire to preserve memories and your own, but also the memories of the people you've lost, is goes back as far as Homer. I mean, it's really very basic to the idea of writing.
In the Farewell Symphony, you speak of the character Josh, who's original, I knew a bit myself, as training you to write a kind of book review that would be appreciative and calculatedly useful to one's own writing career. And it seems to me that given that, one would not be writing articles of this sort if one didn't feel that it was safe at this point to do so, that something has definitely happened, and that it is all right to fly in the face of these previous standard bearers because something else is afoot. Is that the case?
Well, I think, I mean, if anything, I think I'm perceived by an awful lot of younger critics and writers as being overly Mandarin anyway. I mean, it's not as though I'm some young rebel who is trying to tear down the edifice of culture. First of all, I think that edifice has pretty much been dismantled by other people and is lying in shards all around us. But I don't really worry about my reputation, which I think tends too much toward the Mandarin image. I mean, the other day I was interviewed by somebody who said to me, you know, well, it was a young lesbian writer, and she was saying in this interview that I was perceived as this terribly Mandarin and distant and what was the word she used? Well, anyway, the idea was that a kind of elegant, dandified figure. And I said, look, my mother never wore shoes till she was 16. I mean, I've worked, every penny I've ever had, I've had to make on my own. I never had any advanced degrees. I never had any breaks in life. And in fact, having emerged as a gay writer at the time when nobody wanted gay writing and there weren't any places to publish it, I mean, I had a long haul, which is really documented in this book. So I've never really felt like well, I don't know what I'm saying. I guess I'm just saying that I don't identify really with this elitist image that people have of me. But if they have an image, that's the one they usually have.
In the Farewell Symphony, what carries the reader is the intense sociability of tone. It's almost as if the telling of anecdote is meant to be itself seductive, so that in an odd way, although it's not exactly style that you read for, it's some implicit overtone of intimacy that draws you through the book.
Somebody who read the book said he was almost embarrassed reading the book because it was so intimate. It was like somebody whispering in your ear. And, I like that. I mean, I like that idea because it's interesting because I think that people who know me very well, when they read Forgetting Elena or Nocturnes for the King of Naples, my first two books, would say, well, I like it all right, but I can't imagine you writing those books, and I don't see you in them. Whereas I think now I'm so much in my work, and I'm so interchangeable with it, that when I get a bad review, for instance, I fly into a rage because it's as though somebody has attacked me personally. I mean, there's no way that I can get any distance on that because it is me. It is my life.
So I'm curious because this is the first book in the trilogy to be dealing with figures that I would of necessity recognize,
right,
whereas the previous figures were ones who did not share with your private knowledge of them a public life.
Well, of course, that just follows the trajectory of my own life because when I was growing up in the period that I cover in A Boy's Own Story or The Beautiful Room Is Empty, I really didn't know anybody famous, and it wasn't until I was in my early 30s that I began to meet recognized or published writers who helped me and then introduced me to others and people in the art world in general. And then when I was in my late 30s, early 40s, I was the director of the New York Institute for the Humanities, which I don't talk about in this book, but which was a place where people like Joseph Brodsky, Susan Sontag, and many other well-known cultural figures, Derek Walcott, were members, and Richard Sennett. And You know, so that was a period when I was really beginning to meet a lot of interesting people. That's how I met Foucault, and I met Roland Barthes that way. And I would play host to Borges and things like that. So it was a very exciting period in getting to know people. And I've never been particularly a groupie or interested in meeting famous people. I've almost always avoided it because I always feel like the writer's best shot is in his writing rather than – I mean, I remember – well, I think I even have the Eddie character in this book saying, oh, this young guy wanted to meet Robert Lowell, Elizabeth Bishop, and me, and I just laughed and said, well, you'll only find these empty shells propped around a table because whatever we had, we put on the page, and now we're sort of exhausted, empty shells. Well, I don't feel like an empty shell, and I don't feel that the people I've named are empty shells. But on the other hand, it is oftentimes true that whereas a great writer will seem very mature in his work, he'll seem completely puerile in real life. It's a kind of interesting masking sometimes of one's flaws.
Well, the reason I bring this up is not the obvious and practical that as one gets older, the people one knows are known, but rather that in the first two volumes, it seems like the inner subject or one of the inner subjects is betrayal. The impressiveness of a boy's own story seems to be that the boy betrays his teacher, that there is not very much in the way of permanent loyalty, and that he has a certain ruthless nature, not that the world doesn't. In the second volume, the figure of the doctor, among others, is one that he enjoys treating to a dose of his own medicine. Here, the characters are less likely to be betrayed. It seems more as if the truthfulness here has become tribute rather than betrayal.
Well, there's also, I mean, I guess I have such a sociological bias, but I also see a kind of sociological or historical background to what you're talking about. And I think it's that my generation, the Stonewall generation, was one that was sort of halfway between an older gay world of people who felt that they needed to be very, very cultured in order to earn their credentials as homosexuals. And that, I mean, it was a world in which you had to have an opinion about Maria Callas and you had to have read Nietzsche in order to gain the entrance to the cocktail parties where you would meet other erudite gay people. And then today, the modern gay man who's totally buffed and running off to the gym and body fascism and totally brainless, you know. So I think that my generation was the first generation that was going to the gym and that was trying to look tough and being the clone generation, but that still, at least in New York, felt a fascination with this older world of very cultured people. And so I think that the narrator of this book will sometimes, go to a poetry reading and then rush off to the docks to have sex. And there's this constant, and I wanted to show that radical juxtaposition between those two ways of living that seemed to me very characteristic of New York life of the 70s.
Could it also be historical as well that perfidiousness was a requirement psychologically in the 50s in order not to be the person one was accusing someone else of being?
Absolutely.
And that self-acceptance made that, if not obsolete, not obligatory?
Absolutely. I think you've put your finger on something very important because I think that, you know, I mean, the 50s was obviously the period when it was the J. Edgar Hoover era when homosexuals were investigating other homosexuals and denouncing them for their homosexuality.
Now, tell me, I want to come to the sexual subject and the kind of crazy, it seems to me, accusations against this work, that its depiction of certain unsafe sexual practices will jeopardize future readers. But this is a truly politically correct subject. It's the kind of thing that one thought would never in fact happen, but makes Lolita, for instance, a troubling book now, whereas then one picked it up and said, well, only an idiot would mistake the intents of this book. But if you do, as you've said in an essay, believe that readers are seduced by books, that many people discover their sexual nature in the books that they read, or at least used to, or the music that they hear, what is your feeling about that?
Well, I think first you have to start with the truth. And so I think the novel's primary obligation is to the truth and to just depict the era and his own past and his own actions and the actions of people he knew in as honest a way as he can. And I don't think it does any good at all to rewrite history. I also think that the kind of literary Stalinism which has beset gay literature from the very beginning has always been something that serious artists have had to work against. I mean, I think from the very beginning, gay writers were expected to provide the community with positive role models. Well, that's obviously an idiotic idea, and if we had actually followed that idea, it would have meant producing a very shallow literature. And I think that the idea that a 20-year-old would wade through the 500 pages of my book and then come out of it and rush off to a back room is so absurd when you think that that all you need to do is look at any porno magazine that lies around or any movie, a porno movie. I mean, there's so much gay visual material that is encouraging people to sexual excess. I think, if anything, my book can be read as I'm afraid it could be misread as a morality tale. I mean, in other words, it could be read as, in the bad sense, it could be read as a book in which everybody indulges sexually too much in the 70s and they're all punished and die in the 80s. I mean, it could be read that way. And while I was working on it, I was careful to put in defenses of the one-night stand, of so-called anonymous sex, and to show that those can be some of the most incandescent experiences one can have, in order to head off any notion that I might be condemning the sexual and social experiments of the 70s, which to my mind are still very relevant and very interesting. And I stand by them with much more strength than I would behind the neoconservative arguments of most of the gay leaders today.
I remember feeling that we don't have a book that captures the beauties of the strangeness of the counterculture, those transgressions, those oppositions to receive values, that implicit motto that all received wisdom is incorrect. Distrust what you are told by someone other than a person of your own generation. And the strange kinds of anti-logic and beautiful nonsense that we don't have, really, the great novel of that time. It seems to me that The Farewell Symphony is the novel of a slightly later time, gay, and almost as if it is the obligation of art to say, well, something once happened that we are so much in the process of losing that it must be described accurately so that you will know it did in fact occur.
Oh, bravo. That's very well put. I mean, that's just what I felt. And, I mean, sometimes you feel, well, maybe nobody even wants to know about all this. I mean, maybe it's just the slate has been washed clean and it should be left that way. But there is, I did feel very much that there was something terribly vital about all the contradictions and all the cultural richness of that period that needed to be written about. And I'm glad you feel that my book approaches that.
Now, the title, The Farewell Symphony, has been, you know, explained by critics to refer to the Haydn symphony in which one by one musicians leave the stage, leaving the stage finally bare, one musician. But it doesn't seem to me to be the structural principle on which this book is based, nor is it a book that contains a huge number of deaths, just two or three significant ones. So I wanted to ask you about your reasons for the title.
Well, I think I feel that, I mean, for instance, of the writers group that I belong to, the Violet Quill, of the original eight members, only three of us are still left alive. So I do have that feeling of being a kind of witness to a vanished age. And so maybe the title describes almost more my stance, the stance from which I'm writing, than it does the actual content of the book. Although I did feel that, I mean, this is maybe a little too technical, but I think you like this sort of thing, that I felt that the traditional bourgeois novel is something that suits heterosexual life very well. In other words, you have a small cast of characters circling around each other and deciding whether to get married or not. If they do get married, it's a comedy, and if it ends in adultery, it's a tragedy. But anyway, it's a terribly coherent piece of writing. And it seemed to me that form really wasn't suitable to the kind of gay life I wanted to describe, which had an enormous cast of characters. So I thought I'd like to go back to an earlier period, to picaresque writing, in which it really was clearly episodic. But the great problem with picaresque writing was always how to end it, because you always felt like you'd always just tack on another episode. And so I thought that I'll introduce all these people and then in the last 50 pages almost start revisiting them and being told of their deaths as they kind of go down one by one. And it's true that I only stop to render two or three deaths in a very important way, but I do mention the deaths of an awful lot of the people that we've met through the book. And I wanted to make the reader feel how startling that was to live through, to know all these people who were sort of in mid-project with their lives, and all of a sudden, boom, it's terminated. And to see all these ambitions cut short, and this picaresque novel suddenly put in rapid reverse, and it's as though you're sort of seeing this long, rather disjointed film suddenly replayed and going backwards in this kind of Max Sennett tragic ending.
I've been speaking to Edmund White. His most recent novel, The Farewell Symphony, is the final volume as well of his trilogy, beginning with A Boy's Own Story and The Beautiful Room is Empty. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. We've had additional production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join us again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.